from WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. The number of deaths linked to vaping is now over 10, and more than 500 people have been hospitalized with lung damage linked to vaping. That's according to the Centers for Disease Control. They've recently warned against vaping, and Ned Sharpless, the acting commissioner of the FDA, told a House committee hearing this past week that, quote, e-cigarette products are not safe. Here in Massachusetts, Governor Charlie Baker has declared a public health emergency and a four-month ban on the sale of all e-cigarettes. It all begs the question, how did we get here? How could e-cigarettes be on the market if the FDA themselves say they are not safe? Lauren Lempert is a law and policy specialist with the Center for Tobacco Control Research and Education at the University of California, San Francisco. She joins me now. Lauren, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Last week on this show, we spoke with a physician and researcher, Dr. Farah Karadmand of Baylor College of Medicine. Her research has shown that vape juice alone, just not the nicotine or the THC or the flavors or anything else, can cause lung damage in mice that looks just like the people who are showing up in emergency rooms. And she said, you know, these haven't gone through FDA safety testing, and yet they're on the market. So how can that be? How can these vaping products be on the market without any FDA approval?
That's a good question, and you're right. And in addition to the study that you discussed last week, there have been many other studies in addition that show that e-cigarettes may be linked to cardiovascular disease, to other pulmonary diseases, and maybe even recently a paper came out that the mint and menthol flavors themselves may be linked to a constituent that is carcinogenic. The question about how they can be on the market makes all of us scratch our heads, because FDA has had the authority since August 2016 to regulate e-cigarettes.
August 2016, what happened then that gave FDA the ability to regulate e-cigarettes? Why wouldn't they have always had that ability?
Okay, so without getting too wonky, FDA got authority over all tobacco products in June 2009. However, at that time, in the language of the law, it only limited FDA's authority to cigarettes and smokeless tobacco. And the language was to any other products that FDA deems to be under its authority. So it took from when they had the opportunity to regulate e-cigarettes in 2009, it wasn't until 2014 that they first started the process. They proposed a rule, which we call the deeming rule. And that deeming rule was finally enacted in May 2016, and it became effective in August 2016. So that means that FDA got the authority to regulate e-cigarettes in addition to all the other tobacco products and other newly deemed products in August 2016.
Words like opportunity and authority, though, are different than something like an obligation or a responsibility to. Do they have to regulate e-cigarettes, or is this an optional thing that they can choose to do or not to do?
It's a mandate. I'm glad you clarified that. It's a mandate. They were given the mandate to regulate e-cigarettes in August 2016.
And it's now 2019. FDA has said in the past couple of weeks with this, what's becoming almost a crisis with people showing up in ERs with lung damage linked to vaping, they've said, we're going to come out with something soon. But companies like Juul, one of the major e-cigarette manufacturers, were already in a process, right? There's a deadline, I believe May 2020, where those companies have to come to the FDA and be able to prove that they are a net benefit to public health.
So as the law stood, all these products would have to submit applications by August 2018. And if they did not receive a marketing order a year later, they could be pulled from the market. However, in August 2017, FDA announced that it was going to extend that deadline from August 2018 to August 2022, four more years. And then on top of that, the products could remain on the market until FDA ordered them off. So indefinitely. And that's where we are right now. But then about a month ago, FDA announced, oh, this is a big problem. We're going to roll that back or move it forward to August 2021, which is hardly encouraging. And the reason why the deadline now is May 2020 is only because health groups filed a lawsuit and a federal court ordered the deadline to be May 2020.
Lauren Lumpert, we've been discussing where e-cigarettes fall in a regulatory framework right now, assuming that e-cigarettes are just a recreational tobacco-like product. But they're often framed as being a way for smokers to quit and potentially a safer alternative. If they were actually, though, to be declared officially a way to quit smoking, they would face a completely different set of regulations, right?
That's right. If a company wants to claim that their product is useful for therapeutic purposes, including quitting or cessation, they would have to go through FDA's drug authorities. What we've been talking about so far is FDA's tobacco authorities. No e-cigarette company, to my knowledge, has ever applied for that authorization. And what's disconcerting is that not only the companies are making these claims that the products are safer or could be good for cessation, but FDA itself has made statements that imply, if not outright state, that these products are safer and could be used for cessation. But there is no proof that that's true.
So what kind of evidence do we have here? Because obviously there are plenty of academic researchers who have been looking at this over the past several years, trying to figure out, is there a net benefit to vaping? Who's actually using these products? Are there more teens, you know, getting hooked on nicotine through vaping, or are there more adults who are using it to quit? And what is that balance? So based on that research, what do we know at this point?
Well, one good study that came out in 2018 that looks at this very issue, and they concluded that for every one adult who might successfully quit smoking using e-cigarettes, there would be 80 youth who would start using.
80 to 1.
Right. The ratio is probably worse now because that data was based on pre-Juul explosion of use.
Right. And we've seen in, you know, the past 2 years, 2017 until now, numbers released, I think, just in the past month, showing that use has doubled since 2017 among teens and that it's now something like a quarter of high school seniors who are using e-cigarettes.
Yes, 27.5% of high school seniors are using cigarettes as compared to the most recent
e-cigarettes
as compared to the most recent data for adults from 2018. So it's a year ago, 2.8% of adults are using e-cigarettes. But then what we do know is that the predominant use pattern is dual use, meaning most adults who use e-cigarettes have not quit completely. They are using e-cigarettes along with conventional cigarette smoking. And
wow.
And there's research showing that using both products together may be actually more dangerous than using either one of those products alone.
Lauren Lumpert, looking forward from where we are right now and where e-cigarettes are in a regulatory framework, what's kind of the next step? You know, we've got things in place in Massachusetts, like a four-month ban with officials saying that's to give them time to figure out what the next steps are. FDA has said we'll have something more rigorous soon, right? But realistically, what would we need to know and how long would it take to create some more evidence-based regulation around e-cigarettes?
Gee, I don't know how long it would take because e-cigarettes are relatively new. And of course, the gold standard would be longitudinal studies, and they haven't been able to have longitudinal studies. But there is, as we discussed, many studies that have come out, and FDA funds 9 academic research centers to do research. They're called the TCORs, Tobacco Centers of Regulatory Science, where I work, University of California, San Francisco is one of them, to do this kind of research to help inform FDA's regulations, and that's promising. And listen, there are things that FDA could do right now that would help the problem even before these solid longitudinal studies come in. For example, they have the authority right now to regulate flavors, and they have not done that.
And to be clear, the motivation there with restricting the sale of flavored e-cigarette products is not necessarily because those flavors are toxic, but because those flavors appeal to youth.
Exactly. We know that most youth report that that's what attracted them to e-cigarettes, and that's what keeps them using e-cigarettes.
So possibility that FDA might eliminate the flavors. Any other near-term steps that you see?
Well, one thing that we know is what has made this new generation of e-cigarettes especially attractive is their design. We know Juul, but there are others like that that are very sleek. They're easy to hide. They're sexy for teens. They like them. And FDA has the authority, especially when they're reviewing their pre-market applications, to not authorize for sale a product that's especially attractive to kids. The law provides...
Make them clunky and ugly.
they have the authority to set marketing provisions. Another thing is that this current generation uses this nicotine salts, which make the nicotine level higher and easier to smoke with a higher nicotine level. So that's making them more addictive and easier to use and therefore more attractive to kids. FDA has the authority to regulate that. Now, they had proposed 2017, even as far ago, a proposed rule to reduce the nicotine level, but only in cigarettes. But they could address not only the nicotine level, but the mode of delivery of nicotine that's making it so highly addictive in these new e-cigarette products.
We've been talking about this, and you know, you work in a center that is a tobacco products research and regulation, and there's obvious connections between e-cigarettes and traditional cigarettes. We are decades into knowing that smoking causes lung cancer, that these are dangerous products. And I've heard people in the past week or two say, well, if we're going to talk about banning vaping, why wouldn't we just ban all cigarettes? I want to kind of flip that idea a little bit and say, okay, we haven't banned cigarettes. We've just put warning labels on them that say, we know this is dangerous and bad for you. Use at your own risk, essentially. Can you imagine doing that for e-cigarettes? Just, you know, if we were to figure out exactly what the dangers are, just put a warning label on e-cigarettes. And based on our experience with smoking and those kinds of warning labels, would you expect that to actually reduce the use of e-cigarettes?
So two questions. One, FDA does have the authority to require warning labels on e-cigarettes. As I recall, the warning label is something like, warning, this contains nicotine. Nicotine is addictive. And we have research showing that that kind of warning label is not effective, especially for kids. Kids do not understand what it means to be addicted. But most people don't believe that they will stay addicted. They think they'll try e-cigarettes or regular cigarettes, and then they'll be able to quit later when they want to. And that's just not the case. So we know that particular kind of warning label is not effective. FDA would have to come up with better warning labels to make them effective.
That's Lauren Lumpert. She's a law and policy specialist with the Center for Tobacco Control Research and Education at the University of California, San Francisco. Lauren, thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Measles outbreaks around the country earlier this year focused public attention on the risks of non-vaccination. In many places, anti-vaccine sentiment based on religious beliefs or fears about vaccine safety has been on the rise, and that has many public health researchers concerned. But my next guest says that anti-vaccine attitudes aren't the whole story, at least here in Massachusetts. In fact, non-medical exemptions, often called religious exemptions, account for a third or less of all Massachusetts students who are not fully vaccinated. So what else is going on? Nathaniel Fuchs is a Fulbright scholar in the Masters of Public Health program at Brown University, and he recently wrote about the vaccination gap for Commonwealth Magazine. Nathaniel, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
We should start off by saying that according to the National Center for Health Statistics, Massachusetts in 2016 actually ranked number one for fully vaccinated children, at least in the kind of toddler years. So it's not that Massachusetts is doing a bad job of getting kids vaccinated, right?
That's correct. And actually, for the measles vaccination, Massachusetts is doing really well, as 96.9% of kindergartners vaccinated.
But the flip side of that means that 3.1% of kindergartners are not fully vaccinated, and only about 1% have a non-medical exemption. And that number seems to increase with age. It's actually a bigger gap at seventh grade than it is at kindergarten, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So the gaps for the statewide average is 6.9% of the whole population.
Wow. So how do we actually know this? I mean, I've seen data before tracking the number of non-medical exemptions, the number of people who have this government permission to not get vaccinated. But how do we know how many more kids there are who are not fully vaccinated but don't have one of those exemptions?
The Massachusetts Department of Health actually publishes data on this. So it's pretty clear where people fall. You can see the level of unimmunized children, or who are people who don't have any immunizations at all. And you can see the people who have exemptions and people who are in the gap as well.
Is this a common phenomenon across the country, or do we even know, or is this just a Massachusetts thing?
I think in every state, there's a certain level of people who are in this, what the Massachusetts state actually calls the gap. I've done research in Vermont as well, and we saw the same problem there.
So, Nathaniel Fuchs, when you look at this gap between the number of kids who have non-medical exemptions and the number of kids who are actually vaccinated, what's driving that gap? Why are a few percent of Massachusetts students not exempt but also not fully vaccinated?
So there's a lot of things going on there. Some of it is anti-vaccination, but those people, as we've talked about, go to the exemption. The people in the gap are there largely for logistical reasons. There's also vaccine hesitancy, people who aren't quite sure. But most of those things can be taken care of with some fairly simple measures.
So what would some of those measures be? I mean, when you talk about just logistics, what logistics are we talking about?
So getting your kid to the doctor, even. You have to take a half day off work. If you have two or three kids, then it's a lot of effort and coordination to actually get your kid to the doctor, to be healthy, to get the vaccination. If we, for example, we mentioned in the article that if you provided vaccinations in schools, as is done around the world in many places, and also in the U.S. in certain situations, that'll make it much easier for people to get the vaccine and should deal with a lot of this gap.
When I first read your article as a parent of school-age children, my first reaction was, how can there be kindergartners and, for that matter, seventh graders who are still in school and not fully vaccinated, right? We all have to sign those forms and hand in vaccination documents to the school to say, yep, my kid is ready to start school. He or she has had all of the required vaccinations. What happens in that gap where children are still in school and not fully vaccinated?
So that's a great question. And actually, in Massachusetts, it's up to the school district to decide how they enforce vaccination regulation when it comes to the exemption process. So there's actually a new bit of legislation coming out, the Community Immunity Act, that hopes to kind of deal with some of the ambiguity around there. But the gap is negotiation. It could be parents who are saying, oh, we want the vaccine. We don't want to sign the exemption. We just haven't gotten to it yet. Can we get some more time?
I mean, this idea that actually enforcing the vaccination rule could actually push people to sign an exemption, to ask for an exemption, and end up reducing vaccination rates because it's just easier than actually getting your kid to the doctor to get vaccinated.
Yeah, it's this really interesting system where it's actually, having done a lot of research with school nurses, I know it's actually very difficult to enforce this legislation. Because as you say, if you really push hard and tell them, oh, you have to get the vaccine today because that's when the electronic health record wants it, then they might just say, well, I'm signing the exemption. In fact, I had a friend at the State House who said that, you know, I'm pro-vaccination, but my mom signed a religious exemption when I was a kid because I had to go to camp and I hadn't got the vaccine yet. And it was just too much effort to do that day. Yeah.
Well, Nathaniel Fuchs, I mean, that's one tricky situation with a law that does require children to be vaccinated before going to school. But as you've said, this is a phenomenon that the state of Massachusetts is aware of. Is anything being done to address that gap, to address what are the known sticking points with the current rule or other, you know, the other logistical and access issues that come into play here?
I think a lot has been done in Massachusetts to address low vaccination rates. I don't mention specific interventions in the article, but actually we have a very high vaccination rate for most vaccinations. I think that this new legislation, the one I just mentioned from Senator Rausch, the Community Immunity Act, is kind of moving in the right direction, looking to standardize the process and make sure that the legislation is actually enforced how it's intended.
Given that, as we said at the outset, Massachusetts already ranks number one for vaccination of young children, and as you said, vaccination rates tend to be above 95%. That's kind of the crucial number that a lot of experts point to as the safety threshold for herd immunity, for having enough people in a community immunized to stay safe from things like measles outbreaks. I mean, how much of a problem is this vaccination gap?
It's a problem. It's a big problem. Because in some places, even though the statewide average, for instance, in seventh grade is 6.9%, some counties have gap rates much higher than that. So I'm looking here in Berkshire County in the 18-19 year, for seventh grade, had 21% of people in the gap, 21.4%,
wow,
which is huge. So it is a problem.
Right. The tyranny of averages there. If we just look at the whole state of Massachusetts, things might look fine. But when you get down to the actual community level, where, of course, viruses could be passed, some communities are in much worse shape.
Yes, absolutely.
So the Community Immunity Act, one possible solution. You also mentioned, just offering vaccinations in schools. Is that something being looked at here in Massachusetts or elsewhere around the United States as a possible way to increase vaccination rates?
I'm not sure it has been. And that's one of the things that I hope this article will kind of introduce into this nation is the idea that we can change the vaccination system itself, the actual way that people get vaccinations. Not just so much the regulatory and the enforcement aspect, but also the method by which people get their childhood vaccines.
And in fact, you argue that that could be more effective than trying to change people's minds about vaccines when it comes to actually achieving the vaccination rates that we need.
Absolutely. I think the nudge theory has been proposed many places, but this is one of those ideas that I think it would really work, that you just have to make it easier for people to get them and harder for people to get out of them, and then more people will get the required vaccination.
Nathaniel Fuchs is a Fulbright Scholar in the Masters of Public Health program at Brown University. He recently wrote about the vaccination gap here in the Commonwealth. He wrote about that for Commonwealth Magazine. Thanks so much, Nathaniel.
Thank you so much for having me.
Up next, could climate change be driving a global surge in nationalism? We'll talk through the evidence when Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. This past Monday, teen climate activist Greta Thunberg scolded world leaders at the UN for failing to address the increasingly obvious and severe impacts of climate change. On Tuesday, President Trump used his address to the UN to blast globalism.
The future does not belong to globalists. The future belongs to patriots. The future belongs to sovereign and independent nations who protect their citizens, respect their neighbors, and honor the differences that make each country special and unique.
The two addresses may seem completely disconnected, but my next guest argues that, in fact, the worsening effects of climate change could drive the rise of nationalist policies and politicians. Joshua Conrad Jackson is a doctoral student in the Department of Psychology and Neuroscience at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He recently wrote about the link between climate change and nationalism for theconversation.com. Joshua, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So at the heart of this potential link between climate change and nationalism is a concept called cultural tightness. Can you just explain what that is?
Cultural tightness refers to the strictness of rules and the intolerance of people who break rules across cultures. And so this is something that has been recognized by intellectuals since the Greek historian Herodotus. And it's been discussed by anthropologists for a long time. But recently, it's become a really important concept in studies of culture and how culture affects psychology. And the co-author I worked with on this paper, Michelle Galfand, has been studying this for about 7 years now and linking it to a whole host of psychological variables. And here we link it to prejudice and right-wing nationalism.
So it can also be linked to climate change or to unpredictable climate or to extreme weather events. And it could be both, in an evolutionary sense, a benefit, or it could pose risks to a particular society. So let's walk through some of those. Let's say you've got a society facing a rapidly changing climate and extreme weather. What would some of the benefits of becoming a tighter culture be?
Yeah, so one of the major precedents of tightness is ecological threats. And it's generally because ecological threats like natural disasters or disease outbreaks or many of the threats related to climate change create potentially destabilizing events for cultures. And during these times, it's very difficult to maintain cooperation and coordination. So what that means in general terms is it's easier to riot or loot. It's most important to ration, but it can be most difficult to enforce rations. And so to enforce stricter rules in cultures can sometimes be necessary to make sure that people are cooperating, working together as a community to get through threats.
There's a subtle difference, though, it seems, between cooperation and cultural tightness, which sounds almost more authoritarian.
Well, cultural tightness isn't necessarily authoritarian. Cultural tightness just refers to having punishments in place if people aren't following cultural norms or regulations. And so you can argue that the justice system is a form of cultural tightness. But what we're getting at with right-wing nationalism is that when cultural tightness reaches an extreme, it can foster the kind of right-wing nationalists who aren't just punishing people for breaking the law, but also punishing people just because they follow a different religion or they're a different race or they have a different sexual orientation. Deviations from the norm that don't really impact how society functions.
So how could cultural tightness, potentially that version, but cultural tightness as a whole, be a potential liability in a climate change scenario?
Generally, when you have extremely tight cultures, these cultures are led by right-wing nationalists or people who are very intolerant of globalism. So we discussed Trump earlier, who's a good example of this kind of person. And historically and contemporarily, these are the people that have been the most ignorant, some would argue intentionally ignorant, of the effects of climate change. And so at its worst, this could create a really dangerous cycle where the types of threats that encompass climate change could drive people towards right-wing nationalists, but then right-wing nationalists are the most likely to ignore these threats and ignore the policies that come with climate change.
So Joshua Jackson, we've seen over the past decade or so climate change getting worse, and we've also seen nationalist politics and politicians on the rise, not just here in the United States, but in many places around the globe. So those two things are happening simultaneously, but just because they're happening at the same time doesn't mean that one is causing the other. You've laid out ways that they might be connected or have been connected in the past. What's the evidence that right now in the politics that we're seeing that these two things are actually linked?
Well, I think you make a really good point in saying that just because these two things are rising together, it doesn't mean that one is causing the other. And I think that our studies, even though they make a convincing case that these things are linked, they aren't the final decision. There needs to be a lot more research on this topic. What we do find is that the places that have the most intolerance towards minorities today are the places that have endured the most natural disasters and the most historical threats over the last couple of hundred years. Hmm. And so we don't just find this across nations like Turkey or South Korea, but also amongst American states. The states that face the most common natural disasters are those that are currently the least tolerant of people who are different. And that holds even controlling for other likely factors, like how often people move between communities, which can foster tolerance, or people's levels of conservatism. And what we also find is that when you run an experiment, and so you put some people in a condition where they're asked to think about the threats facing society currently, and you put other people in a condition where they're asked to think about difficulties in their personal life or threats to their well-being in their personal life, you find that people who were primed to think of threats facing their society express more prejudice towards minorities when you ask this question afterwards. And also, these are the people who are most likely to vote for right-wing politicians. And we found this by doing surveys during the French election involving Marine Le Pen and the most recent U.S. presidential election involving Donald Trump.
That's a really interesting study. I mean, you had something like 1,000 volunteers. And as you were saying, you not only had them think about, but they had to write about either a threat in their personal life, a threat in their environment or their society. And then I love your control is they had to write about their breakfast, which was hopefully not very threatening.
Yeah, we wanted a control that didn't have any threat.
But the goal there was to try to actually run an experiment to see if you could essentially induce this kind of cultural tightness or intolerance by getting people to think about climate change. How dramatic was the effect?
Well, what people would do is they would write about threats facing their society, and then they would endorse a series of statements getting at cultural tightness. So things like, we need stricter rules in our community, or we can't afford to be tolerant of people who are different in our society, or people who break the law and who violate rules should be punished more harshly. And then we asked about people's attitudes towards minorities, ethnic minorities and racial minorities. And what we found was that people were about a scale point higher on a 1 to 7 scale in terms of their endorsement of culturally tight statements. So things like, we need to punish people more harshly who break the rules. And they were also more likely to express prejudice towards minorities. But what's particularly important is that it was only the people who endorsed more cultural tightness who were the ones who expressed more prejudice. The manipulation didn't have any effect for those people who didn't express more cultural tightness, who wrote about a threat facing their society. And so it's really important to recognize that culture is a really key modulator of this process.
So someone can come from a background of less cultural tightness and respond to that same threat to climate change in a very different way.
Exactly. Yeah. Another way of saying it would be, if people are thinking about a threat like climate change and they don't think that you need to change culture, then that threat really doesn't have any effect on prejudice.
Joshua Jackson, this is an interesting kind of conundrum to think about in the context of our current politics, because as you've already alluded to, President Trump and many of his supporters are those most likely to deny the reality of climate change. So how could a threat that they are denying be driving the nationalist agenda and people's voting habits?
Well, they're denying the threat, but people are feeling the effects of these threats. And you don't necessarily need to connect a politician like Donald Trump with a solution to climate change to feel like you need someone who can enforce law and order when your community is faced by natural disasters. And I think that another really important point here is that tightness doesn't need to be negative in the face of climate change. I think that something that my collaborator Michelle Galfan argues in a book that she recently published, Rule Breakers, Rule Makers, is that there are a lot of really healthy forms of tightness that can come out of the threat of climate change that we face right now. And the sort of regulations that the Trump administration is currently rolling back, like regulations on pollution for producing products, manufacturing products, these are good examples of healthy forms of tightness that we should really be highlighting rather than, you know, the kind of nationalist tightness that you're seeing today.
At the same time, you also point out that the way it seems to be playing out right now with the rise of nationalism can lead to a vicious cycle where as we were just talking about, if, you know, President Trump denies the reality of climate change is not taking action to address climate change gets worse. That feeds more nationalism. That feeds less action to address climate change. Yeah. You know, you see where this goes. It's kind of headed toward runaway nationalism and climate change. Is that what you see playing out right now?
That is a sort of worst case scenario. Yeah. And it's something that comes out of the research that we've done.
Is it inevitable based on the research that you have done? I mean, you've also said that there can be beneficial forms of tightness and there can be differences in cultural backgrounds that lead to very different responses. Is there any research that points towards interventions or ways to change that trajectory and end up at a different place?
I think it's a really important avenue for future research. Because what I think will be very important going forward is directing people towards healthy functional rules and really unhealthy toxic rules. The types of rules that exclude people just based on their race or their religion are what we've historically seen come out of natural threats. But the types of rules that we need right now are effective ways of implementing sustainability and helping fight climate change.
That's Joshua Conrad Jackson. He's a doctoral student in the Department of Psychology and Neuroscience at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He recently wrote about the link between climate change, cultural tightness, and the rise of nationalism for theconversation.com.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, we dive into the world, or really the many worlds, of quantum physics. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Physics is one of the oldest fields of scientific study, with some of the most mature theories and laws about how the world works. But those theories don't always match up perfectly with each other. The way physics is explained if you're talking about bridges and airplanes is typically different than if you're talking about quarks or electrons. For that matter, some ideas that seek to explain how our world works seem to fly in the face of our lived experiences and the observations we make. My next guest is trying to bridge those gaps using quantum physics, and fair warning, it's pretty mind-blowing. But unlike many others, he says quantum physics is something we should be able to understand. Sean Carroll is a theoretical physicist at the California Institute of Technology, host of the Mindscape podcast, and author of several books. The latest is Something Deeply Hidden, Quantum Worlds and the Emergence of Space-Time. Sean, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thanks for having me.
You frame this book as a step toward resolving a crisis in physics that arose in 1927. So take us back to 1927. What was happening and what was this crisis that arose?
Well, the crisis was the birth of quantum mechanics. It had taken a while. Quantum mechanics, the first stirrings of quantum mechanics were in 1900. But by 1926-27, they had put together what we still use today and still teach in textbooks as the modern version of quantum mechanics. But it had a huge problem, and it still has a huge problem. Namely, it seems that quantum mechanical systems, like a little electron, some other tiny subatomic particle that we use quantum mechanics to describe, seems to evolve one way when we're looking at it and another way when we're not looking at it. And this is satisfying to nobody. Like, why should looking at something have any effect on anything? What do you even mean, looking at it? And so we try to solve this problem, but to be honest, we haven't tried very hard. So I try to make the point in the book that we should be trying harder.
Well, this idea, as you say, that's not satisfying to anybody is actually, I would say, far more than not satisfying. It's actually deeply disturbing to a lot of people, this idea that there is some deep and perhaps unresolvable distinction, difference between what we observe and what really is. I mean, that has led to this idea that maybe quantum is not understandable. Is that why there hasn't been the effort, you think, to actually try to delve more deeply into quantum physics and really understand what's going on?
It's a great question why physicists have decided to do this, have decided to sort of put this whole big problem aside and focus on other things. One, you know, to be fair, there were plenty of other interesting things to focus on, right? We're talking about the birth of nuclear physics and particle physics and astrophysics and a whole bunch of cool ideas that you could explore without touching the measurement problem of quantum mechanics. But I think the other one was, you know, it seemed a little disreputable to sort of bang your head against this idea that was quasi-philosophical when you had a theory that worked well enough, even if you didn't completely understand it. And I think that today we've reached the point in the development of physics where that refusal to try to understand quantum mechanics is holding us back in our actual other physics areas.
So explain that a little bit more. What is it that we need to understand, or I guess maybe why do we need to understand this about quantum physics? I mean, we have landed rovers on Mars. We have cell phones and computers that function, and for that matter, bridges that function every day. We have clearly some sufficient understanding of the physical world to have done all of these things. What more would we gain by understanding quantum physics?
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. In fact, we can use quantum mechanics incredibly well. It's the best tested and implemented scientific theory in all of history. But where we're using it is sort of in this microscopic realm where you have atoms and electrons and other kind of particles putting them together to make lasers or transistors and so forth. But these days, we're being a little bit more ambitious. We'd like to describe the universe, the Big Bang, black holes, places where gravity is very important. And famously, gravity has resisted being brought into the quantum mechanical fold. We can quantize, if you like, all the other known forces of nature, but gravity, it doesn't quite work. And so I try to make the case that should we really be surprised that we don't understand quantum gravity when we don't even really understand quantum mechanics?
Well, Sean Carroll, the name of this book that you've written about understanding quantum mechanics is Something Deeply Hidden. Would you tell us what that something deeply hidden actually is?
Yeah, the quote is from Einstein. Einstein is one of the heroes of the book because he actually gets a little bit of a bad reputation. Everyone thinks Einstein was smart, but he was actually even smarter than we give him credit for, because when we were having these debates over quantum mechanics in the 1920s, people sometimes say, well, Einstein had grown a little bit old, he'd lost touch, he wasn't able to keep up. But in fact, he appreciated the difficulties of quantum mechanics as well as anyone, and he understood quantum mechanics itself as well as anyone. And the quote is actually in a different context. He was talking later in life about when he was a kid and he was first handed a magnetic compass. And he noticed that wherever he would turn, the compass would still know which direction north was in. And he said, there must be something deeply hidden that explains why this is doing this mysterious thing. And that was also Einstein's attitude toward quantum mechanics. It's not that the theory was wrong. It's that we don't understand it. There must be something that explains why things are happening the way they are. Now, my favorite example, my favorite version of what is actually happening is what's called the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, which was proposed a year or two after Einstein passed away, so he didn't really know about that.
But still, it goes back quite a ways. It's not necessarily a new idea. So what is the many worlds? Is it a hypothesis, a theory at this point to try to explain what's going on kind of under the hood with quantum mechanics?
Yeah, if you believe in quantum mechanics at all, if you believe that the way that we describe quantum systems has some relationship to reality, in other words, it's not just a bookkeeping device, then you believe that a tiny particle like an electron can be in what we call a superposition. It's not necessarily located at this position or that position or spinning in one way versus the other way. It's a combination, a superposition of all these different possibilities.
It's probabilistic. It's kind of, there's a probability of it being any or all of those places and in those conditions at the same time.
I'm trying to be very precise here. The probabilities come in when you look at it.
Aha.
But when you're not looking at it, it really is in all the places at once. It's not that we don't know or that it will be. It's that it really is in the combination of all these different places. That's what a superposition is. And so in ordinary quantum mechanics, we say it's in a superposition before we look. When we look, the electron or whatever snaps into some particular value. We always see it located one place rather than the other. What Hugh Everett, who was the student who invented many worlds, said is, what you're forgetting is that you are a quantum mechanical system. and that means that you can be in superpositions too. And in fact, what naturally happens when you observe an electron is that you and the electron evolve very simply into a superposition of the electron was there and you saw it was there, plus the electron was over here and you saw it over here. And furthermore, all of those different parts of the wave function of the universe, as we call it, describe different worlds. That's why it's called the many worlds theory of quantum mechanics.
Okay, I've often wished that I had multiple of me to try to get everything done in my day. but I wanted all of those me's in the same world. And what you're saying is that I guess I'm everywhere doing everything that I could possibly be doing, but all in different worlds. There's an infinite different set of realities.
That's right. Every time a tiny quantum system like an electron becomes entangled with the big outside world, the universe branches into multiple possibilities. And yes, there's multiple copies of you being created many, many, many times per second. But also all of the things you have to do and all of your worries are also being duplicated every second. So you don't really catch up anymore just because of quantum mechanics.
I think I'm feeling actually farther behind
exactly.
Now than I was. It's not actually helping to have multiple of me. I mean, this seems like a really extreme, perhaps, version of what to me at least is a more common idea, which is the multiverse idea, that there are multiple universes, perhaps an infinite number of universes. But this is just kind of bringing that down, well, I guess to the quantum level, that there's an infinite number of everything within the universe. And it kind of destroys the idea that there is any reality.
I don't know. I think that there is a reality, but it's just a much, much richer reality than we're used to from our everyday experience. And after all, why should we expect that reality is just what we see in our everyday experience? This has been the lesson of science since Copernicus, that reality is much, much bigger than we tend to give it credit for. We tend to be pretty parochial when we approach reality. And you're right, this is different than the multiverse that cosmologists talk about. But what it has in common is, in neither case, in neither the quantum many worlds nor the cosmological multiverse, did scientists just like sit around after dark in their dorm rooms and say, like, what if there were all these universes out there? You know, in both cases, they predict the existence of all these universes based on the equations that they derived to explain the world you do see. So the argument is that the simplest explanation of what we see predicts a whole bunch of stuff we don't see, so we might as well believe in that stuff until we have good reason not to.
You say that your understanding of quantum physics and many worlds to you leads to a deeper and richer understanding of reality. And I wonder if you could try to share with us how your understanding of your reality is richer because of this, when this idea is, to many people, completely off-putting and seems to deny reality, make things seem perhaps the exact opposite of a richer reality, less real.
Yeah, no, I think that's a perfectly fair issue. And as you point out before, in the book, I take pains to point out that we don't know that many worlds is right. There are absolutely alternatives that are worth taking very seriously. But many worlds is sort of the most lean and mean version of quantum mechanics that there is. I know that sounds absurd because there's a potentially infinite number of extra worlds.
Doesn't sound very lean or mean.
Doesn't sound very lean or mean. But it has the fewest equations. It has the fewest concepts. It has the fewest ideas into it. Every other version of quantum mechanics can be thought of as start with many worlds and then dirty it up, add new things to it, because there's all these other worlds there and we don't like them.
Sean Carroll is author of Something Deeply Hidden, Quantum Worlds and the Emergence of Space-Time. Sean, thank you. I was told that my mind would be blown speaking with you, and I think we definitely accomplished that.
My pleasure. That's what I'm here for.
And that's our show. Until next week, I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.